Microsoft has where they're doing build updates, and the design behind it is saying, look, we want to have an operating system that is secure and that it will do major build updates. And the major build update system allows certain companies to specify your business could specify that you want to lag behind and only run build 1803 for Windows 10 until maybe build 1809 has been out for 6 months, and then maybe you want to adopt build 1809. So it gives organizations the ability to have a pace of adoption of the builds. It also gives other organizations the ability to stay up on top of what the latest and greatest build is so that they can have the latest and greatest security features. So I actually really like the system, and they're doing build updates for other things too, such as the Microsoft Office software now, which as of Office 2019 is all click to run delivery method, as opposed to the volume licensing method that existed previously with multiple activation keys or even retail packages. So Office 2019 is now all click to run, and it also has build additions. So this enables significant feature updates, additions, changes on top of the security updates. So it's just in general a much better way of doing operating system and software delivery. Now, as part of this, what Microsoft has been doing is trying to deal with the ramifications and challenges of this methodology in terms of disk space consumption. There were some foolish manufacturers that deployed systems that only had 128 gigabytes of hard drive space, or maybe they had 256 gigabytes of hard drive space with poorly managed storage. And there's two tales there. Number one, I would never recommend anybody to use a hard drive smaller than 256 gigabytes for any device that is going to run a full operating system, a full Windows operating system, whether we're talking about Windows Server or Windows PC, laptop, desktop, workstation, whatever. So at a minimum, 256 gig hard drive. Now, there are some Surface computers that were sold through Best Buy and some other outlets that only had 128 gig, and the problem with those is they started dying at like build 1507 or whatever it was. So some really old version of Windows 10, which is no longer supported anymore, at some point, those machines became unsupported because the end users didn't know how to get through the process of doing a Windows 10 build upgrade while not having enough hard drive space in order to accomplish that. And there are some ways to get that done. So the trick is, how do you have enough hard drive space? Well, Microsoft might have gone a little overboard with trying to help people accommodate this, and what they've done is literally removed the backing up of the registry as of build 1803. It's terrible. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, how large is the registry? It's less than 1 megabyte. And even if it was 5 megabytes, that's really kind of irrelevant as well. So I think it was a catastrophically bad decision for them to make to remove the registry backup as part of a build upgrade process. And there was so much blowback about this very poor decision that they have published an article that is stating how you can deploy this periodic backup mechanism for the registry via a mod. So you can do a manual modification. And we're going to be deploying this mod to all of our client systems so that they have registry backup again. And by the way, registry backup is nothing new. This has been something that we had from an automated process going as far back as 1998. And So it's always been important to back up the registry. There have always been ways to automate it, and as of Windows 8 and Windows 10, that process, we didn't have to automate that anymore because the operating system was doing it by default. Well, and then Microsoft went and messed that up. But now they've given us the ability to turn that feature set back on so that there will be periodic backup of the registry. Anyways, I'll publish a link to that article. Now let's talk about the secondary aspect type of scenario where a hard drive will not have enough disk space in order to run a build update. So let's say you do have a 256 gigabyte hard drive and you go and you look at the space and maybe you've only got 5 gigabytes of free space on your hard drive. The reality is that's not going to be enough in order to get a Windows 10 build upgrade completed. You would need 8 to 10 gigabytes of free space at a minimum in order to make this process work. So let's say you've looked at the disk space utilization and you don't think there's anything you can delete without breaking something, which you're probably correct. There's a little product called Space Sniffer, which is a non-installing executable that you just download and launch. You would have to run it as an admin, and it will then scan the whole hard drive. And it's probably going to take a while to scan it, but then it will tell you where the big consumption of disk is. Now, I looked at a computer recently that had this problem happening, and what I found is that there were still old things out there that the Windows Disk Cleanup Manager was not handling, meaning it was not deleting those. So I launched an admin command prompt, and then I ran Cleanup Manager, which is clean MGR, all one word, clean MGR. And I ran the Windows Disk Cleanup Manager and let it do its thing. But there's still only about 5 gigabytes of free space. So I ran Space Sniffer and looking at what the consumption was. And it turns out there was a system recovery folder that had an oodle of stuff out there, about 25 gigabytes, which is a lot. So clearly that's where I needed to focus my actions. And I looked at what was there and I saw stuff from 2016, 2017, 2018 out there. Clearly just a whole lot of old junk that needed to go bye-bye. And I kept getting access denied errors on deleting that stuff. So what I did is ran a take ownership script on that and then ran another script to delete that stuff. And it turns out about 300,000 objects were deleted. So it took quite a while, many, many hours. I think it was about 6 hours that it took to run. And that solved the problem. And then the computer had over 30 gigabytes of free space at that point. Fantastic, right? So that if you're encountering that sort of a problem, then I would recommend you take that approach as well, of using Space Sniffer and looking through those types of things to see how you can free up disk space. But don't ever delete anything that you don't know can be deleted for sure. So let's move on to some other relevant security updates that have to do with privacy and security. One of the things I saw was a really interesting article talking about the basis of the Boeing 737's Max software and the issues associated with it. You know, there's been quite a lot of scrutiny about that particular software for the Boeing 737 Max. And, you know, why have we had these, why have we experienced these crashes as a worldwide community? Is it preventable? How did it happen? You know, there's been investigations into this. Turns out that Boeing had hired $9 an hour engineers out of India that had barely just managed to graduate from, you know, computer programming school. So these were people that had almost non-existent experience, and they certainly didn't have any of the decades of experience of the former Boeing software developers that had been working on these things, you know, previously. So in 2015, there were a couple hundred senior software engineers at Boeing that were just laid off, and Boeing said, you know, we don't need you anymore. And their solution was to hire these companies out of India that were going to be contracted with to do this code for the 737. And you know, there's a lot of mistakes associated with that. And engineering really is not a commodity. The interesting piece is that there's been some analysis by other engineers that have stated that if you actually look at a standard software engineer in the United States who's experienced and appropriately credentialed, and let's say they're getting paid somewhere from $35 to $40 an hour, when you look at the actual real cost of these $9 or $10 an hour software developers in India, they're really more like $80 an hour because of the extra need for supervision and then all of the mistakes that are being made by these underexperienced engineers. And these folks also just did not have the same sort of dedication to security and safety first sort of programming that had historically been part of a Boeing software development culture. So that's very problematic. What they're going to do about that, I don't know, but I think it's interesting. I think it's a very interesting case in how it's not actually really saving a company money to do things like that. The next article I thought was really interesting was MailChimp is now MailChimp, for those of you that don't know, MailChimp is a volume emailing service. And I've always thought it was kind of baloney anyways. I've never used any of these bulk emailing services, but there are a lot of people that use them because they just don't have the technical proficiency to know how to do it any differently. They're very expensive. You end up paying per newsletter list member to services like MailChimp, even whether or not these people are opening the emails. You know, so if you have, let's say, 50,000 people on a mailing list, and your open rate is 2%, you're paying for all 50,000, even though you're only getting the benefit of 2%. So it makes them a lot of money. And I just don't believe in using any of their services from a, I don't think they're cost effective. And then this article that I saw where it was stating that MailChimp is now blocking sending of all emails about content, legal content, I might add, legal news content that they just simply disagree with. So, for example, let's say you're a subscriber to MailChimp and you have a health newsletter and it happens to contain content that MailChimp disagrees with. There's nothing illegal about sending people a newsletter that has information in it that MailChimp disagrees with, yet is completely legal. Right? There's too much of this tampering that these companies are doing where they're trying to construct, they're trying to engage in thought structuring instead of just being agnostic and sticking with what the law says is allowable. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with, and nor would anyone probably disagree with a statement that says you can't use our platform to do things that are criminal. Fine, that's a reasonable thing. You don't want your service, if you're a service provider, you don't want your service being used for people to do criminal things. But as long as it's not criminal, then the content of it shouldn't be any of your business as a service provider. So MailChimp is now going into, as I said, this thought structuring aspect where they're saying, well, if you're going to send out email newsletters to an email list and then pay us for it, that's the key piece too. You're a subscriber that's paying them for the service. But if there's any content in there that they don't like or that they disagree with, then they're just going to disable your account. And legality has nothing to do with it. So there is an alternative out there. There's a company called Ariel Software, and they have a product called Campaign Enterprise. So you can, if you're interested in making a change, I would certainly recommend everybody getting off of MailChimp and using Ariel Software's Campaign Enterprise. And there's other alternatives out there too. Like, let's say you had a content management system, which was your website. So you could buy a plugin for your CMS. It could be something like RS Joomla has an RS Mail newsletter handler. And by the way, you might be paying less than $40 per year for that thing. I mean, these things can be very, very, very inexpensive. And that you could have tremendously much better success with as opposed to using some, you know, some other system like MailChimp. So I would suggest that if you have your own email infrastructure and you're technically savvy enough, then you should probably just look at a CMS add-on for your website that is a mail newsletter component. Other than that, take a look at Ariel Software's Campaign Enterprise product, and that way you can be assured that you will be able to continue to have access to your content and that it will work. And oh, by the way, I've also read some articles that I thought was fascinating where some people were even reporting that MailChimp and some other service providers like them that were engaging in this thought structuring process, they were just literally disabling the accounts and denying you as the account owner who had paid them, denying the ability to even export and download the email list. And so now their email list is a hostage, basically. Yeah, when you're selecting service providers, it's really critically important that you've really truly properly vetted them. And I don't really entirely know how somebody outside of the IT security community is even in a position to be able to do that. I don't know. Fortunately, you know, this is what I do for a living, and so these types of stuff is easier for me. But anyways, hopefully that information is helpful to you. Now, let's talk about Apple, a change that they're doing now, which I think to be beyond unacceptable. So Apple has now changed their privacy policies. Their new privacy policy, as of June 6th, is stating that they're now changing the way they're going to use your personal information header, and all images that you're uploading. So if you have your phone set up such that it'll take these pictures and it will auto upload them into your iCloud account, then in the time that these images are getting auto uploaded, what the service is doing is it is scanning your content by default without your consent. And it's literally scanning it with telemetrics on it for anything that it thinks is potentially illegal content. And then it's, you know, going to be storing this stuff. Now, there are some people that have concerns about this where they think that Apple has been utilizing a product called PhotoDNA, which is technology that Microsoft developed way back in 2009. Now, PhotoDNA's intent originally was to prevent child exploitation by computing a unique hash represented by the image of child pornography. And then it can look for things like alterations in the image, resizing, color alterations, converts from black and white to color, vice versa, etc. nonetheless, this is a matter of, you know, for whatever you think about this, it's a matter of you should be aware. Now, maybe you consent to this, maybe you don't consent to this. If you don't consent to having your content scanned and potentially stored by iCloud, well, I guess you should disable that feature that says my iPhone is going to upload all of my photos into the iCloud. So my main thing here with this is that you need to be aware that a lot of this technology is just spying on you ubiquitously all the time, and maybe you don't care, but if you do care, then you should know and then take some actions for that. Another article I found really interesting was a man was actually put in jail for 44 days because he refused to unlock his iPhone. Now, there's been some hot debate going back and forth about searches and such. Sometimes law enforcement gets a search warrant, sometimes they don't. Sometimes, depending upon the jurisdiction and case law that has existed in a particular jurisdiction, they can compel you to utilize biometrics to open and unlock a smartphone. In some cases, they can just use smartphone hacking and cloning software. So it really depends on your the jurisdiction that you happen to be in as to what their exact capacity, capabilities are, and how they're going to handle it. But there was a man who was stopped and then was put in jail on an obstruction of justice charge because he wouldn't unlock his smartphone for a law enforcement officer when the law enforcement officer had no warrant for that. Now, law enforcement said that they advised that they were intending to obtain a warrant, but the individual declined to unlock the smartphone, assuming that law enforcement was fishing for evidence when he hadn't done anything wrong. Well, as it all turned out, he spent 44 days in jail. He was never charged for anything, and his contempt of court order was voided. So, he spent 44 days in jail, you know, uncompensated. There's no content in this article here that's talking about whether or not he lost his job as a result of it. I can imagine if you're in jail for 44 days, it's kind of hard to keep your job. And what happens in the context that you have an apartment? And you don't have like auto bill pay for your apartment and your phone bill and everything else. So what happens to your entire life when your bills aren't paid? You know, I think we know the answer to that. There certainly have been circumstances where this has happened to people who were unjustly jailed and their entire life was destroyed. All it takes is, you know, roughly 30 days for you to be in jail, and then your life can just be completely fried because you're going to lose your job, potentially lose your apartment, your home, foreclosure things start happening, all kinds of services get shut off just because you're not paying bills, you don't have any mechanism, no way to pay bills, you have no way to even know that bills need to be paid. Wow, yeah, catastrophic. So he has no way to recover that time and chaos back from his life, and it was just a fishing expedition that went bad. So it's interesting. I thought it was very interesting. Next article is talking about Customs and Border Patrol was admitting that hackers got into the Customs and Border Patrol imaging system that also included up close license plate recognition cameras, as well as cameras that were photographing, you know, deep and up close faces of people in their vehicles. And this system was hacked, and it was hacked because these images had found their way onto the database of a government subcontractor. So in this case, Customs and Border Patrol themselves weren't hacked, but it was a subcontractor that was doing some work for them that was hacked. you know, this goes back to this component of, you know, retention policies are a problem. There's entirely too much retention of all of this stuff for too long, and access control to this content is not being done properly. Too many transitive trust agreements with subcontractors that have agreements with subcontractors and so forth. Oh, I had a conversation last week with a client about, they were talking about getting a service through a company, and I said, well, have you asked them to disclose to you that if you sign up with this service through them, how many people at their company will have full administrative access to all of your content in an unfettered, unauditable way that you have no access to know about? And what security measures are they mandatorily utilizing in their organization in order to protect access to your data? The conversation was rather interesting because he said, well, gee, they didn't bring up any of that stuff when I talked to them, you know? And that's not surprising. Most service providers are not going to have frank discussions with you about identity and access management control and security access controls if you do business, if you as a customer do business with them, you had better know how many people at their company have access to your content in order to provide you support for the services that you require. If they can't answer that, and if they can't articulate exactly what security control measures they've got in place in order to protect all of that in detail, including multi-factor authentication, IP access control restrictions, and so forth, then I strongly suggest you look elsewhere. Yeah, major problems. And I would suggest that there's also another alarm bell you can look at. If you're looking at an IT service provider who has taken the photographs and the names and, God help you, LinkedIn profiles of everybody that works in that company, especially the IT engineers who would be doing support, and put that stuff as publicly available information on their website. Sure, it may give you warm fuzzies to know what these people look like and to know some cutesy little things about them, but the reality is that that has just exponentially opened up the target on their back as a high-value target to the hackers, who fundamentally are doing massive targeting of anyone and everyone that has any pretense of being in IT systems management, which is why if you go to the QPC website, you won't find any photos or cutesy profiles or names of people that work at the company. That's privileged information. You won't find that information because I don't want to give that information to the hackers so they can just start doing spear phishing or try to find ways to do public record searches on people and find out what their cell phone numbers are to send them maliciously crafted text messages. And ultimately all that ends up in leading to attempts to hack, which then can breach people and cause problems. So I strongly suggest not doing business with companies that put all of their people's information out there in the public, because it is a really bad idea. Maybe it's great if you're a public relations firm, but it is not good if you're an IT services provider. So that's it for the show today. Hope you have a good weekend.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Apollo astronaut historian Jim Gibbons will discuss the space goal proposed by JFK in 1961 that was fulfilled for the U.S. in 1969. The program is free and will be held at Matheson Memorial Library in Elkhorn on Tuesday, August 6th at 6:30 p.m.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi.